I'm Heather Vale, and this is the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show. Joining me is Silver State Equality State Director Andre C. Wade and Program Manager Jessica Munger. Silver State Equality is Nevada's statewide LGBTQ plus civil rights organization, and their 2023 youth survey revealed persistent challenges for LGBTQ plus youth. Andre and Jessica, thank you both so much for being here today.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks for having us.
So first of all, what exactly does Silver State Equality do?
As you mentioned, we are a statewide LGBTQ plus civil rights organization. Our mission is to bring the voices of LGBTQ plus people and our allies to the institutions of power to create a world that is healthy, just, and fully equal. And so we do that by passing poor quality legislation, getting poor quality candidates elected to office, and we have advocacy and public education programming. So we have a C4 and a C3 designation.
Okay, cool. And when was the organization first founded?
We were first founded in 2019 and really got things rocking and rolling in 2020, right before the pandemic hit us, which is really where the Student Advisory Council was born out of. In the summer of 2020, our board of advisors were meeting about what was happening and getting reports about the impact that stay-at-home measures was having on students, really compelled us to want to do something to address the issue.
Yeah, okay. Now, who participated in the Silver State Equality 2023 Youth Survey?
So the Youth Survey was a project of the Silver State Equality LGBTQ plus Student Advisory Council, which is a group of students and adult mentors who put this survey together looking to learn more about the experiences of LGBTQ youth in Nevada. And so we sent the survey widely across the state to junior high and high school LGBTQ plus students all over. So we had a diverse group in terms of location. We had 6 counties represented. The median age of the sample was 16 and school year was 10th grade. So we had junior high and high school students giving us their realities. It was really powerful.
Okay. And what are some of the most revealing results from the survey?
Yeah, so we had results that, you know, surprised us in terms of the amount of experiences that these students are having. So 60% reported having been teased by peers for being LGBTQ within the last 6 months. We had nearly 80% of students report to us that they had faced discrimination from those in authority for their LGBTQ plus status. So those are just a few of the outstanding numbers that showed up in our survey.
Those things, 60% of LGBTQ plus kids were teased, 60% in the last 6 months from taking that survey. That seems like something I would have expected to hear, you know, 20, 30, 40 years ago, but not in today's day and age. So what's going on?
Yeah, exactly. That's a really good point. It was shocking that that's still happening to these students. So, you know, my perspective is that the political climate in the country right now around LGBTQ rights, we're seeing a lot of legislative attacks. We're seeing particularly trans students being used as pawns for this political agenda from the right. And that no doubt trickles down, right? The things that these adults, these parents are saying are no doubt reaching the ears of fellow students and becoming real problems in schools for students' everyday lives. And so that's what I'm seeing, is that the student bullying is probably mirroring the actions of the adults around them.
So it's really the parents and other adults in the teens' lives who are the impetus for this bullying and pressuring of LGBTQ plus youth?
Well, and I think just the general volatility in the culture around it, you know, when trans and other LGBTQ plus students' very existence and rights are being challenged, I think that that is going to create a culture that, you know, breeds violence and bullying towards kids. So, yeah, you know, I think there's a real cultural problem that we're seeing right now.
Yeah, definitely. So what kinds of solutions can we put in place to address the problem?
So we know that there are a lot of great laws on the books that protect LGBTQ plus people in general and students specifically, anti-bullying laws as an example. What we need to do is make sure that these policies are being implemented throughout the state at each school district. So that's one thing that we need to do. And we want to make sure that teachers and administrators are getting trained to better care for LGBTQ plus students. So whether that's a 1 hour training every year or having more information woven into pre-existing trainings, I think that's something that can be tackled. And then also we just need a stronger investment in mental health services for children and adults in general, again, specifically for LGBTQ plus students and children, because there's a dearth of resources, and where they exist, we want to make sure that those providers are trained up to care for LGBTQ plus students and children.
Yeah, I mean, that's a really good point, because bullying, regardless of what it looks like, bullying can be devastating to young people. And they need to have mental health support and resources available to deal with the emotions and the feelings that come up from this. So you said there's a dearth of available mental health support. What is available for these kids, and what else could we implement instead?
Right now, there are just a few providers of mental health services in Southern Nevada, as an example. And there might be a small percentage of those who are competent to provide LGBTQ plus services. And so with those, there's probably long waiting lists. And so we just need more providers to get into the system and provide care. And then again, have those providers be competent. But then also in schools, if we are showing that out of the folks that we surveyed, the students that we surveyed, if 60% of them don't feel comfortable going to their counselor at school, then that's problematic. We have to figure out, like, what is the issue there? Because if resources are in place, but they're not being utilized, then that's a totally different conversation. So those are the things that we need to assess and address, hopefully in partnership with each of the school districts.
Yeah, okay. So, Jessica, besides the bullying and teasing and general negativity, what are some of the other key findings that stuck out for you from the survey?
Yeah, so one theme is that LGBTQ students are not seeing themselves represented in curriculum. And we know at this point that representation is incredibly important. And there was a bill passed a few years back that does require schools to be including specific groups of people, change makers, history of LGBTQ movement of different groups. And it's slow to be implemented is what we're seeing. Many students said that they had never read a book by an LGBTQ author as assigned in school, or heard stories or seen themselves and their community represented in curriculum. And so these things, policy takes time to be implemented. And so we know that that's coming, but surely it's happening slowly. So we do hope that as more inclusive curriculum is implemented, that will change. And that seems to have a big impact on students.
Yeah, for sure. So what ways are there for people to get involved and help out the Silver State Equality Organization in making a difference?
You know, with these findings, I think it's clear that our students need support from the adults who are willing to offer it, who are allies, who are accepting parents and guardians. And so we hope that ally parents, supportive parents are involved in school districts. We know that there are a lot of attacks against LGBTQ students happening at that level. So pay attention to school districts, pay attention to efforts to ban books and show up at these local discussions to advocate for our students. I think that's one big way. Another is to share these findings, because I think that awareness helps us to understand the need for these policies, and that creates a cultural support for the legislation that we're trying to pass. So staying engaged on a local level, specifically with schools and libraries, and sharing the information goes a long way.
I would add that people can sign up to volunteer with us. They can go to our website, silverstateequality.org, and sign up for our newsletter and stay informed and sign up to volunteer. We send out information to engage folks. So there are some ways that people can really get involved throughout the year.
Nice. Okay. SilverStateEquality.org is the website. And so people can find out more information about Silver State Equality and sign up to be a volunteer on the website. Is there a way to also see the survey results?
Yes. On our website, under our publications, you'll find the survey results right there. And we'd love for you to share them widely.
Okay. Awesome. So once again, silverstateequality.org is the website to go to, silverstateequality.org. If you'd like to see the results of the 2023 youth survey that Silver State Equality did, just look under the publications tab on the website and you can find all the information of the survey that we've been talking about today. You can also sign up to be a volunteer and help out Silver State Equality with their mission. And once again, all of that is at silverstateequality.org. And we've been speaking with State Director Andre C. Wade and Program Manager Jessica Munger. And I want to thank you both so much for being here and letting us know these results, which I agree are surprising and shocking in this day and age. And it's a really important topic. So I'm glad you're bringing awareness to us here today and providing a way for people to get on board and help out and make a difference. So thank you both so much.
Thank you so much, Heather, for highlighting this really important issue. We appreciate you.
Yes, thank you.
Walking into the building for the first time after the shooting, it was crippling, but it had to be preserved.
In response to the Pulse nightclub shooting that affected the LGBTQ community, Barbara Poma, owner of Pulse, founded the One Pulse Foundation to honor Pulse victims and survivors.
If you're an ally of this community, speak out. There are more of us together than apart. It is the power of love in its rawest form.
Join the fight for LGBTQ acceptance. Learn how at lovehasnolabels.com. Brought to you by Love Has No Labels and the Ad Council.
I'm Heather Vail, and this is the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show. Joining me is Justine Adams, Board Vice President for Gigi's Playhouse Las Vegas. The organization is about to open their 59th brick-and-mortar Down Syndrome Achievement Center here in Las Vegas. Justine, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you so much for having us.
So what exactly is Gigi's Playhouse?
Gigi's Playhouse is an international network of Down Syndrome Achievement Centers that have both virtual and brick-and-mortar locations to service individuals with Down Syndrome and their families in communities.
Okay. What exactly happens at the Down Syndrome Achievement Center?
So we provide therapeutic, educational, and career development programs for individuals with Down Syndrome, really age zero through lifetime. So we service infants, school-age children, teenagers, adults. We'll be there to support families that receive a prenatal diagnosis as well.
Okay. What are some of the specific programs that Gigi's Playhouse offers at these centers?
Gigi's Playhouse has a wide range of signature programs, but our location in Las Vegas will be opening with a program for each age level. We'll start with ages 0 to 3 with our LMNOP program, which is a language and music program for newborns to age 3 that help teach basic sign language and other forms of communication through music and language-based activities. The next program will be for school-age children, and that's a dance program. It'll combine social engagement and thoughtful design to create an upbeat and exciting environment for school-age children 5 through 12. We'll also have a Teen-tastic, which will serve students or children ages 13 through 17, where they'll build social skills. So it'll be a group, actually, it's an inclusive group for individuals with and without Down syndrome to teach social skills through team-based activities. And then our adult program, we're opening with our signature GG Fit program, which is a physical therapy program with strong fitness focus and goals of success for improved movement and health.
Nice. Okay. So when exactly will the Las Vegas Center open?
Our grand opening is Saturday, March 9th. Starting March 12th, we will be open Tuesdays through Saturdays, 9 to 3.
Okay, awesome. So who can take advantage of the programs and resources?
So although we're a Down Syndrome Achievement Center, space permitting, we will service any individuals with any intellectual or developmental disabilities. So anyone can come and check us out and see what we have to offer that might actually work for them and their families.
Perfect. Okay. So it's called Gigi's Playhouse. Who exactly is Gigi?
Gigi is a very spunky 21-year-old gal from Chicago. Her mom started this. Her mom, Nancy Gianni, is our founder and chief belief officer. And she started this program 21 years ago for her daughter, Gigi, that was born with Down syndrome.
Nice. That's awesome. So where can people go if they want to find out more information about Gigi's Playhouse and the various programming that's available at the new Down Syndrome Achievement Center here in Las Vegas?
People can find out information on our website, which is just ggsplayhouse.org/Las Vegas, or on Instagram and Facebook at Gigi's Playhouse Las Vegas.
Perfect. And where exactly is the Down Syndrome Achievement Center located?
We're located at 1535 West Warm Springs Road in Henderson, Nevada.
Perfect. Okay. So once again, ggsplayhouse.org/Las Vegas is the website to go to, ggsplayhouse.org/Las Vegas. You can also find them on social media at Gigi's Playhouse Las Vegas. And the latest Down Syndrome Achievement Center is opening here in Las Vegas. This is the 59th location, but first one here. And starting next week, March 12th, they're going to be open Tuesday through Saturday. That's at 1535 West Warm Springs Road. So you can check it out, see if there's services of interest to you or your loved ones, or look online. Once again, ggsplayhouse.org/Las Vegas, ggsplayhouse.org/Las Vegas. And we've been speaking with Justine Adams. She's the board vice president for Gigi's Playhouse Las Vegas. And Justine, I want to thank you so much for being here and letting us know more about your organization and how it will be serving the community going forward. And welcome to Las Vegas. Glad to have the latest Down Syndrome Achievement Center right here. And thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Heather.
One in four Americans today are living with a disability. I'm one of them. People with disabilities are extremely talented, resilient problem solvers that have so much to offer. And we've got a trusted ally on our side, an organization we can rely on, Easter Seals. Easter Seals is leading the way to full equity, inclusion, and access to healthcare, employment, and education for people with disabilities, families, and communities. That's my Easter Seals. Make it yours.
Learn more and get involved at easterseals.com.
I'm Heather Vale, and this is the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show. Joining me is Lisbeth Chiriboga, TeachKind Program Manager for People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, or PETA. TeachKind is PETA's humane education division, and Lisbeth provides free animal-friendly educational materials to school districts, teachers, and homeschooling parents. Lisbeth, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you so much for having me, Heather.
So what exactly is the PETA TeachKind program?
So TeachKind, as you mentioned, is the humane education division at PETA. And we're all former classroom teachers. I taught myself in New York City for 12 years before coming to work for PETA 7 years ago. And as you mentioned, we work with schools, teachers, homeschoolers, and parents around the U.S. and Canada to help them incorporate compassion for animals into student learning.
Nice. Okay. Now, what is the Words Matter language guide?
So very exciting to say that we're launching this new language guide called Words Matter, as an educational resource to help young people think about animals as living beings versus inanimate objects. It's a free resource that we developed for parents and educators that really provides a fresh take on common phrases with a positive spin and lessons on why language matters. And we're encouraging parents and educators to use this guide to share these ideas with children in a very practical way.
Okay. What are some examples of that positive animal-friendly language?
Okay. So you've probably heard the old saying, sticks and stones may break my bones, but words will never hurt me, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, maybe words don't cause literal physical harm, but they can definitely do immense damage in other ways. Words influence opinions and behaviors on very conscious and subconscious levels. And this is especially true for impressionable children who are still learning how language works. So when we use expressions like kill two birds with one stone, or there's more than one way to skin a cat, or don't beat a dead horse, and really the list goes on and on, It teaches children on a conscious level that animals are expendable, they're undeserving of basic kindness or respect, and it really normalizes violence against them. So TeachKind's new language guide focuses on some particular ways that society traditionally teaches children how to talk about animals that influences really how they think and speak about animals for their entire lives without realizing it. And so an example of that is how we include a list of animal-friendly idioms to use instead, like feed two birds with one scone, And there's more than one way to peel a potato and feed a fed horse. And kids love it. It's fun. And you can see the whole Words Matter guide at teachkind.org/wordsmatter. And the idioms, a long list of the idioms, you could find at teachkind.org/idioms.
Nice. Okay. So besides those kinds of new phrasing, what other kinds of tools are included in the guide?
Well, another aspect we highlight in the guide is how children are taught about nouns. You and your listeners were probably taught that a noun was a person, place, or thing. And mm-hmm. we were told, I was as a child, to put animals in the thing category. But when you think about it, if we classify them as things, we're perpetuating the idea that they're inanimate objects, no different from tables and chairs. However, tables and chairs don't experience life or death consequences if you tire of them and return them to the store. They also don't feel pain or need food and water as animals do. And children understand this distinction. So we provide activities that include a separate category for animals, and many teachers are embracing this more compassionate way of teaching this lesson. We have widely popular activity sheets on the education website, Teachers Pay Teachers, with over 4,000 downloads and great reviews of our nouns worksheets.
Okay, so a noun is a person, place, thing, or animal?
Animal, yes. Well, at PETA, we view animals as people too. But
okay.
For young children, in a practical sense, we suggest adding a separate category for animals, yes.
Yeah. Okay. That makes sense. All right. Now, obviously, there's some great tools and thought-provoking messaging in the Words Matter language guide. Besides that, what other resources does TeachKind offer, either to the public or when you're working with kids in classrooms?
Oh, well, we have lots and lots of free resources, and they're available to anyone at teachkind.org. We have free lessons. We can do virtual classroom presentations. We offer advice. Many times I get on the phone and give one-on-one advice to teachers about how to incorporate these types of lessons into their existing curriculum. And so much more on our website at teachkind.org. Our resources meet Common Core standards and other state academic standards. And some of our resources were even used in a study that demonstrated a significant improvement in students' academic performance as well, while also inspiring students to become conscientious and compassionate thinkers. So the academics and fostering empathy don't need to be mutually exclusive. It can be a win-win for everyone.
Okay. And then for homeschool parents, are there downloadables or printouts that they can use with their kids when they're teaching them?
Oh, absolutely. We have a huge following of homeschoolers for using our resources. And we love working with homeschoolers. They contact us all the time. We've even created materials at their request. So anyone can go to teachkind.org. Most of our materials are available for free download on our website. But we do have some materials that we can mail to anyone who's interested. And please, we ask that you share them with any teachers you know, school officials, libraries, churches, anyone who works with children.
Okay, nice. So once again, teachkind.org is the website to go to. Plenty of resources there. Now, specifically, if you're interested in the Words Matter language guide that Lisbeth was talking about, teachkind.org/wordsmatter, teachkind.org/wordsmatter. And then the idioms, the alternates that you could learn, such as more than one way to peel a potato instead of skin a cat, teachkind.org/idioms. teachkind.org/idioms. And of course, TeachKind is a program of PETA, and PETA's website, PETA.org, PETA.org. And we've been speaking with Lisbeth Chiriboga. She's the program manager for the TeachKind program at People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. And Lisbeth, I want to thank you so much for being here and bringing some of these thoughts and ideas to our attention, because you're right. We grow up learning a certain thing and kind of just take it for granted and forget sometimes the impact that words can have. So I think it's a great program, and I really appreciate you being here and sharing it and the resources with our listeners. So thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me, Heather. It's been a pleasure.
Animals are languishing in U.S. shelters. especially dogs who look a certain way. These dogs are just as deserving of loving homes as any type of dog, which is why we decided to help them get out of kennels. Join the thousands of supporters of our mission to help us expand our national reach and proudly place more dogs from kennels into their forever homes. To learn more about our mission, please visit us at kenneltocouch.org.
This is the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show. I'm Heather Vail, and I'm speaking with Jennifer Perry, co-founder of Foster More and executive director for the Children's Action Network. Jennifer, thank you so much for being here today.
Good morning, and thank you so much for having me today. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk about an important issue.
Yeah. So first of all, what is the Children's Action Network?
The Children's Action Network was founded by people in the entertainment industry to raise awareness about youth and foster care. We recognized that they were really living in the shadows and that we needed to tell their stories and get the public engaged so that we could improve outcomes and provide the opportunities for youth to realize their potential.
Okay. And what is Foster More?
Foster More is along the same lines. It is about telling people who youth in foster care are, encouraging them to get engaged in the lives of youth in foster care in a number of ways, and act as a clearinghouse for people who want to learn more about the issue. Because prior to our founding, it was difficult to get a lot of information about foster care. And we're hoping to change that, and in changing that, really encourage the public and businesses to get more involved.
Okay. Now, what is the current foster care landscape here in America?
In America today, there's just over 400,000 youth in foster care. If you're thinking about a number that matches, it's about the population of the city of Tampa. So there are a number of youth, and the average age of the youth that are in foster care is 8, and a number of them age out every year to uncertain outcomes, and they all need a loving, stable family to help guide them through the milestones in life.
And do we have enough foster homes to do that?
No, we do not have enough foster homes. And I think in part because many people don't know how many foster youth they are. They don't know who they are. They don't understand their resilience, their need. And that's why today I'm talking to a number of people like you to say, these youth are here. They need Americans to step up and help provide them with a place to be, whether they move on to become adopted or go back to their families, but a place where they can come home to and feel stable and supported.
Okay, now if there's a child who needs to go into the foster care system, but there aren't any potential foster parents available, what happens?
Unfortunately, when that happens, they are put in temporary placements, and in systems that are overburdened, those become hotels, other environments that are not great for youth. And that's one of the reasons we're doing this. You don't want to see a youth who's been removed from their family, already traumatized, facing difficult times, be placed in an environment that is not conducive to their healing and their prospering.
Okay. Now, why aren't there enough foster parents in the country? You did mention that sometimes people just don't know about it, but are there deeper issues?
One of the issues is there's great turnover among foster parents over time. And so as foster parents are trained and come into the system, we do lose them. So we need new foster parents because of that. And as I said, I think lack of awareness is a big problem. Foster parents need more supports because it's a Herculean task and it's an extraordinary thing that foster parents do. They're taking a child that they've never met into their home and pledging to take that child on a journey with them. And it really is a remarkable thing. It's a form of national service.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, what did your research find was a big barrier preventing people from becoming foster parents?
We do a lot of research at Foster More. That's one of the things that we do. And what we found in talking to people across the country in focus groups and polls, that there were people, once they were informed about the issue, they're like, I want to step up. Again, Americans want to be involved. They want to step up. But they were like, you know, it's hard for me because I don't have the flexibility at my job. And once they understand that, you know, those first few days or weeks are crucial to bonding with that child, ensuring them that they're in a stable, supportive environment. So we learned that really one way that employers could make a significant contribution was to give their employees that flexibility. So we are asking employers, as part of the Foster Care Friendly Workplace Pledge, to commit to 3 weeks of paid time off, which can be supplemented in states with paid family leave. And we're also asking for some priority in childcare if they have it on site, recognizing that's a rarity, but ideally that's another piece of the pie.
Okay. And what has the reaction been so far from employers when presented with the Foster Care Friendly Workplace Pledge?
It has been fantastic. We have a number of companies that are signing up. We've been working on this for a couple of years, took a bit of a hiatus during COVID, and we are on a roll right now. It is one of those things when businesses are told and their employees are hoping to have this happen. We've signed up probably 8 or 10 new businesses in the last couple of weeks, and we anticipate hundreds more this year. And they range from small businesses to large companies like CBS Viacom and smaller businesses. It's something any business can do to make it easier for their employees to become foster parents.
Nice. Okay. So for people who are thinking of becoming a foster parent, especially now that they know that there is a definite need for it, how do they start that process?
One of the best ways is for them to look within their community, because it's community-based. So to become a foster parent, one of the things you do is you find an agency and they will help you with the training, which takes several weeks or months, and then they will help guide you through the process. So each community has an agency that can help a prospective foster parent through the journey. And if people want to get basic information to sort of have an understanding of the child welfare system and how it works in youth and foster care, I encourage them to go to our website, fostermore.org, because it is designed as a starting place for people to learn about this issue.
Okay. Now, what does someone need in order to become a foster parent? Like, what kind of experience? What are the criteria?
It sounds like I'm oversimplifying, but the truth is an open heart and an open home. Anyone can be a foster parent. Older people can be foster parents. Single people can be foster parents. It really is a willingness to step up and say, I want to help this youth. And that the training helps people as they understand the broader issues and helps support people through the process. But really, open heart and open home is really the best way to say it.
Okay, awesome. And how can they encourage their employer to join the Foster Care Friendly Workplace Pledge?
It would be wonderful if employees did that, and they can ask their employer and tell them that they'll be helping the 400,000 youth in foster care. And I think the best way to do it is to direct their employer to the fostermore.org site, where it spells out how an employer can sign up to be a foster care friendly workplace.
Okay, awesome. So you've mentioned the website, fostermore.org, both for people who are looking for more information on becoming foster parents or employers who are interested in the Foster Care Friendly Workplace Pledge. What else can people find when they go to fostermore.org?
They can find broadly information about youth and foster care. And as individuals, they can find information if they're not ready to become a foster parent, which is certainly very understandable. They can find information on how to get engaged in their community by packing a duffel bag for youth in foster care or providing new clothing and basic essential supplies for youth in foster care. So we have what we call a ladder of engagement on our site, and it is designed for individuals to become involved.
Awesome. Okay, so once again, the website is fostermore.org. fostermore.org. You can find out more information about becoming a foster parent, other ways that you can help out all those kids who are in the foster care system, and employers can take the Foster Care Friendly Workplace Pledge there. We've been speaking with Jennifer Perry. She's the co-founder of Foster More and also the executive director for the Children's Action Network. And Jennifer, I want to thank you so much for being here and letting us know more about the foster care crisis in America and what people can do to help out. Once again, that website, fostermore.org. Thank you so much for your time, Jennifer.
Thank you, Heather, for helping us draw attention to this important issue and all that you do.
Connor spent 5 years in foster care.
Before I was adopted, I felt nervous that I wouldn't have a family. But with help from the Dave Thomas Foundation for Adoption, Connor now has the love and support of a forever family.
After I was adopted, it was amazing. I felt happy.
You can help find permanent homes for children still lingering in foster care. Learn more at DaveThomasFoundation.org.
I'm Heather Vale, and this is the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show. Joining me today is Jason Levine, Director of Governmental Affairs, Policy, and Strategic Planning at the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, or NHTSA. As we spring forward, it's Vehicle Safety Recalls Week, and the NHTSA is encouraging you to check your vehicles for safety recalls. Jason, thank you so much for being here today.
Thanks so much for having me.
So what exactly is Vehicle Safety Recalls Week?
Sure. So every year, we here at NHTSA, the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, we recognize a week in March as Vehicle Safety Recalls Week. We do this ahead of daylight saving time because it's a good moment to remind people when you're changing your clocks, check for vehicle safety recalls. The reason we want to do this is because vehicle safety recalls happen just about to everyone at some point. There were 1,000 recalls last year on over 40 million vehicles and vehicle equipment. So it's really important people get them checked out and, more importantly, get them repaired.
Okay. So is it always at the springtime daylight saving time change that you have people look, or do we do this twice a year?
Well, we certainly want people to look at it twice a year or whenever they think of it. We've actually, in addition to our website at nhtsa.gov/recalls, where you can look this up actively, you can download an app, Safer Car app, put in your vehicle identification number, and not only will it tell you if you have an open recall now, it'll actually ping you if you have one in the future. So we want people to be proactive and go ahead and take a look for themselves. Good time to remember, you know, when you spring forward and fall back with the clocks. But it's also great to just download the app. You don't have to think about it. It'll let you know. So there's different ways of getting there. Either way, we want to make sure people know if they have an open recall and, more importantly, get it fixed.
Okay, so if we find out that our vehicle does have an open recall, what's the process for getting it serviced?
Yeah, that's a great question. And a lot of people don't realize this. Bring it to your local authorized dealer of your vehicle, any local dealer. It doesn't have to be the one you purchased it at. It doesn't have to be the one that's closest to you, the one closest to your work. If it's an authorized dealer of your manufacturer's vehicle, they have to fix it and they have to do it for free. So it's a free repair. No matter where you are, as long as it's an authorized dealer of your manufacturer, they'll do it for you for free anywhere across the country or in your neighborhood.
Okay. Now, is there any type of data on whether recalls most often happen with newer vehicles or older vehicles? Because it kind of seems like once a vehicle's been around for a bunch of years, they've already taken care of all the stuff that was wrong with it in the first place. Or do they just keep discovering things that, hey, you know what? We got to get people to bring this back.
Sure. So I don't know that there's exact data that would be useful in sort of determining whether newer versus older. I can tell you people seem more likely to be paying attention when they have that newer vehicle. And that's probably something that we really want to avoid because, unfortunately, millions of people every year don't realize that they have a recall on their vehicle. Maybe it's an older vehicle. Maybe they're the second owner. So they, you know, don't have the whole history of the vehicle. And the older the vehicle it is, the more important it is to make sure that we're getting it maintained correctly, and particularly when we've got a recall on it. But I do want to mention that all recalls are safety related. There's no such thing as a cosmetic recall. So if you've got a recall on your vehicle, it could be your brakes, it could be your lights, your airbags, your seat belts. There could be a component that's at risk of fire, catching your whole vehicle on fire. So old or new, if it's recalled, make sure you're getting it fixed.
Yeah, well, that's obviously some very important safety considerations. And clearly, it's in our benefit to make sure that our own vehicles are running safely. But how does it also keep our roads safer for everybody?
Absolutely. So, you know, the types of components or defects that we're looking at could affect you and your passengers, your loved ones in the vehicle, or, you know, let's say it's a brake issue. It could actually, you know, impact others on the road, whether it be other people in other vehicles or other vulnerable road users like pedestrians or bicyclists. You know, if you're having a problem with your brakes, that can be a problem for someone else, not necessarily you inside the vehicle. So it's really important to get these fixed. We're actually very excited this year. We've just launched a tool where you can look up your recall with your license plate number. You don't have to memorize that whole 17-digit vehicle identification number. That's a lot of digits and numbers. You can just use your license plate, go to nhtsa.gov and pop in your license plate. It'll tell you whether you have a recall. And also, for those of you who are sort of the car person in your family, you can look it up for your spouse. You can look it up for your parents, for your kids. This is something that's important for everyone to get done because, again, there were 1,000 recalls last year, over 40 million vehicles impacted. So we want to make sure we're getting them repaired and back out on the road as safely as possible and as quickly as possible.
Yeah, that's fantastic that you've added the license plate numbers because sometimes, you know, figuring out what that VIN says, it's so long and it's really hard to read. You have to take a photo and, you know, blow it up and that kind of stuff. Now, what if we just happen to know the make and the model and the year of the vehicle? Can we look it up that way as well?
That's a little bit harder. That might get you. There's some websites that sort of give you like there might be a recall on your vehicle if you just have make, model, and year, but it's not going to tell you whether your specific vehicle is impacted by that recall because it is not uncommon for a make, model, and year. One assembly line run does have the recall impacted by it, but a different one doesn't. You know, because vehicles sometimes are made in different factories and the impact is different. So we would really recommend being able to identify your vehicle personally. So again, whether that's you're using your license plate or using that vehicle identification number, which you can find either on your vehicle in the door jamb, over in the windshield by the driver's side, or on your insurance card. That's usually where I go to look for it, to be honest.
Yeah, that makes it much easier. Okay, so VIN or license plate number, and give us the website again where we can look up and see if we have a safety recall.
Absolutely. It's nhtsa.gov/recalls, or we have an app, Safer Car, the App Store. Download it. It'll tell you whether you have that vehicle under recall right now or whether you have one in the future. It'll let you know in the future. We want to make sure everyone's safe while you're changing your clocks. Make sure you're checking for recalls because save cars, save lives.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, once again, that website is nhtsa.gov/recalls. nhtsa.gov/recalls. That stands for the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, nhtsa.gov. Or you can just download the Safer Car app, Safer Car, and that will tell you if you have any recalls now, as well as let you know in the future without having to go back to the website every time we change the clocks. And we've been speaking with Jason Levine. He's the Director of Governmental Affairs, Policy, and Strategic Planning at the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration. And Jason, I want to thank you so much for being here and bringing us this very important information and at a very timely time of year. So thank you so much.
Thanks so much, Heather. Thanks for having us on.
There are 1,000 ways to say it.
Nope. Knock it off. Shut it down. Dream on. No dice. Give it a rest. Not a chance.
Or just
all text. You focus on the road.
As a passenger, you have the power to prevent an accident. There are 1,000 ways to stop a distracted driver. Choose one.
A message from CTIA.
I'm Heather Vail, and you're listening to the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show. Joining me today is Dr. Cedric McFadden, board-certified colorectal and general surgeon and assistant professor of surgery, as well as Amishi Shaw, who was diagnosed with colorectal cancer last year. March is National Colorectal Cancer Awareness Month, and there are new recommendations for screening and prevention. Thank you both so much for being here today.
Thanks for having us.
So, Dr. McFadden, what are the symptoms of colorectal cancer?
Well, the symptoms are things that you may think about normally, right? Changes in your bowel habits, abdominal pain, unexplained weight changes, or fatigue. You can also have bleeding that can be present either in the stool. The challenging part with colorectal cancer is, in some cases, there are no symptoms. Colorectal cancer can be a silent disease. And if we find, you know, that the patient's not having symptoms, it can delay the diagnosis. And so we are partnering with the Colorectal Cancer Alliance to encourage people to go to getscreen.org to find out how they can find their potential risk and the appropriate screening test for them.
Yeah, I mean, if it's something that doesn't have symptoms, people don't normally think to go get a screening. So why is screening and prevention so important with colorectal cancer?
Well, you know, this is a preventable disease. At 5 years, 91% of patients can still be surviving if it's caught soon enough. And so prevention is quite important for that reason, to prolong survival. But also, we know that cancers start from small polyps that, if left to grow, can become a cancer. So if we can find polyps, if we can find earlier stage diseases, we can, you know, nip it in the bud and obviously then prolong someone's life, better quality of life. But it starts with screening or paying attention to symptoms.
Yeah. Okay. Amishi, what's the story of your colorectal cancer diagnosis?
I was 45 years old and I was living life. I had no time to go to see the doctor. And around age 49, I started noticing some blood in the stool. I ignored it then even. And then I finally went to my family doctor. I got tested and then referred to a colorectal surgeon. And when I got my screening colonoscopy, I was shocked to find out that I had stage 3B cancer. I went through chemo and radiation and lost 2 body parts after that. And now I live with the consequences of that. So I just want to tell you that I found a lot of support through the Alliance, and it's important to get screened.
Wow, that's an incredible story. And absolutely, you know, you're the perfect example of why it's important to get screened. Now, Dr. McFadden, what is the recommended age to start screening for colorectal cancer?
So that recommended age is 45. It used to be 50. But it's now 45 because we're seeing so many younger patients being diagnosed with colorectal cancer. So 45 is for average patients. However, if you have a family history of colorectal cancer, that's going to begin perhaps 10 years before that family member was diagnosed. So you really have to know that history. And regardless of your age, if you're having symptoms, you need to be tested as well.
Yeah, of course. Why is it starting to affect younger and younger patients?
So that is the big question. You know, there's so many factors and so many risks that can be present, from family history to lifestyle. One of the conversations and a lot of research focuses on the environment, on the microbiome, which is the collection of these bacteria and living organisms that live in our gut that may influence the development of these cancers. It could be what we're eating, you know, the types of foods that we're eating, the increased rates of obesity. All these things collectively can increase someone's risk of colorectal cancer. But again, a lot of research has been done on that very topic.
Okay. Amishi, how did your diagnosis make you an advocate for colorectal cancer screening?
It's very simple. It can save your life. I know that over 90% of patients can survive if it's caught early. However, I was part of the 80% of people who, between the ages of 45 and 49, who didn't get screened. I now know how important it is, and now I volunteer to raise awareness.
How many people have you been able to influence to get screened themselves?
After I was going through treatment, I started posting, and through my story, I know that at least a dozen of my friends and family have gotten screening colonoscopies. I'm very proud of that, and I continue to be vocal about how very important it is to get screened early.
Yeah, absolutely. What kind of support is out there for patients and caregivers to help them navigate and take control of their own colorectal cancer journey?
So there is a lot of information and a screening quiz at getscreen.org, and there are other resources for patients and caregivers on colorectalcancer.org.
Okay, fantastic. And Dr. McFadden, what else can people find when they go to getscreened.org?
So it's an interesting process because it takes your own personal factors, your family history, how much you exercise, your diet, all those things, and it helps you determine not only what test options you have, but also it discovers when and how frequently you should do that test. Because it can be overwhelming to think, you know, with all the options there are for screening, which one should I do, and when should I do it, and how often should I do it? That's the site to go to that will help navigate and make it very easy.
Nice. Okay. So once again, the website, getscreened.org. You can go there and find out about screening for you. March is National Colorectal Cancer Awareness Month. So this is a perfect time to go to the website, getscreened.org, and find out more information. It's treatable if there's early diagnosis. So it's very important, especially during National Colorectal Cancer Awareness Month. And we've been speaking with Dr. Cedric McFadden. He's a board certified colorectal and general surgeon, as well as Amishi Shah, who was diagnosed with colorectal cancer. And I want to thank you both so much for being here today. Amishi, for sharing your story, and Dr. McFadden for sharing important information with us. So thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Heather.
Stomach cancer is often misdiagnosed as acid reflux, indigestion, or an ulcer. Because of this, most stomach cancers are found in late stages when there are little to no options left for treatment. I'm not a healthcare provider, just a young mother who lost her husband to this cruel disease. If you or a loved one is experiencing persistent symptoms that can be really common, such as heartburn, having trouble swallowing, or indigestion, you should seek help with a gastroenterologist as soon as possible. You can also contact nostomachforcancer.org for more information.
I'm Heather Vail with the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show, and this is your community events calendar for nonprofit initiatives and charity events around the Valley. March is National Colorectal Cancer Awareness Month, and the Colorectal Cancer Alliance is urging you to get screened with new younger age recommendations. Find out more or take the screening quiz at getscreened.org. That's getscreened.org. As we spring forward, it's Vehicle Safety Recalls Week, and the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration is encouraging you to check your vehicles for safety recalls. Enter your VIN or license plate number to check for recalls on your vehicle at nhtsa.gov/recalls. That stands for National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, nhtsa.gov/recalls, or download the free Safer Car app. Bunnies Matter Rescue is holding their fourth annual Spring Fling next Saturday, March 16th from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. at Floydland Park. Visit with the bunnies at the Bunny Barn and have a fun-filled family day with games, goodies, and gifts. Volunteers are also needed for several shifts. Find out more at bunniesmatter.org or fill out a volunteer application at bunniesmatter.org/volunteers. bunniesmatter.org/volunteers. Monday's Dark with Mark Chinook is a bi-monthly musical fundraising party at The Space, with each event raising $10,000 for a specific charity in 90 minutes. Upcoming shows include Monday, March 18th at 8 p.m. benefiting the Collaboration Center, and Monday, April 1st at 8 p.m. benefiting Nevada Fertility Advocates. Get tickets or find out more details at mondaysdark.com. That's mondaysdark.com. The Junior League of Las Vegas is hosting the Peace Love Las Vegas 5K charity race on Saturday, March 23rd at 9 a.m. at Floydland Park. Find out more or register to participate at jllv.org/5K. That stands for Junior League Las Vegas, jllv.org/5K. The Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department Foundation is hosting the 32nd annual LVMPD Canine Trials on Sunday, March 24th, with doors at 8 a.m. and opening ceremony at 9 a.m. at South Point Arena. General admission is free, and canine teams from law enforcement, military, and casino properties will compete in a variety of events, including agility and handler protection. Find out more or register for free at lvmpdfoundation.org/canine trials. That's lvmpdfoundation.org/canine trials. The 6th annual Walk for Friendship Las Vegas Fundraiser Walk and Community Carnival is happening on Sunday, April 7th, with check-in at 10 a.m., walk at 11 a.m., and carnival at noon at Las Vegas Sports Park, 1400 North Rampart. Support the Friendship Circle's efforts to provide social and recreational opportunities for children and young adults with disabilities. Find out more or register at walkforfriendshiplv.com. That's the number 4. walkforfriendshiplv.com. The Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department Foundation and the Gratitude Project are hosting the 7th annual Hidden Heroes Black and White Gala, honoring the LVMPD Air Support Search and Rescue Section on Friday, April 12th at 5:30 p.m. at Chaos Nightclub, Palms Casino Resort. Find out more info or get your tickets at lvmpdfoundation.org/hidden-heroes. That's lvmpdfoundation.org/hidden-heroes. Habitat for Humanity Las Vegas is hosting their 4th annual Putt Four Homes Golf Tournament on Monday, April 22nd with an 8 a.m. shotgun start at the Red Rock Country Club Mountain Course. Find out more or register to play at lasvegashabitat.org. That's lasvegashabitat.org. Make-A-Wish Southern Nevada is holding their 22nd annual Walk for Wishes fundraising event on World Wish Day, Saturday, April 27th, with 8 a.m. registration and the walk and run starting at 8:30 a.m. at Town Square. Make-A-Wish chapters and affiliates across the globe come together each year to celebrate World Wish Day, the anniversary of the wish that inspired the founding of Make-A-Wish back in 1980. You can join in the celebration of more than 550,000 wishes that have already been granted while raising funds for future wishes. Sign up or find out more information at wish.org/snv/walk. That's wish.org/snv/walk. And Aid for AIDS of Nevada, or AFAN, is hosting the 34th annual AIDS Walk Las Vegas on Sunday, April 28th at 9 a.m. at Las Vegas Ballpark. This year, AFAN celebrates 40 years of providing HIV/AIDS services to the community, and the walk is in partnership with Clark County's Love, Live, Undetectable Equals Untransmittable campaign. Penn and Teller return as grand marshals for the 23rd consecutive year, and dogs are welcome with a signed pet waiver. Register for the event or find out more at afanlv.org. That stands for Aid for AIDS of Nevada, afanlv.org.